Okay, so I noticed that students themselves are actually learning that this machine doesn't start. So they're coming fashionably late, except for, you know, people like Michael who actually shows up on time. Everybody else just have realized that the machine doesn't start anyway, so we can come after 10 minutes and we'll still be in the beginning. I don't know, what can I say? I guess you reduce your tuition payments, you get lower quality machines, you don't need to study. That's good. Anyway, so what I plan to do today is sort of complete the discussion on reinforcement learning and start talking about statistical learning, which is the last big topic for the semester. By the way, you should be ready to be able to make a short presentation, a 15-minute presentation on the paper that you selected. Okay. Probably is going to happen in the last two classes. If I wind up needing those classes, then we will just have to meet extra classes where you can do your presentation, or you videotape it and put it up, and you know, so something of that kind. Okay. And then people can put their camcorders in front of it. That's it. So we are going to, last time we were talking about this. Are there any questions on what we have done till now on the reinforcement learning? Okay. One specific thing that I want to mention is there is a connection, I said, between temporal difference learning and reinforcement and Monte Carlo, and in fact that connection has been formalized in some ways. So for example, you notice that temporal difference just goes one step and backs up right away. Okay, it goes one step, assumes that the value for that state the value estimate from the previous iteration for that state is the correct value, and then uses that to kind of make this guy's valuation go closer to its successor's value plus the reward. Okay, Monte Carlo, on the other hand, you can think of it as it goes all the way down here, and when in fact if you take infinitely long behavior, then essentially just the backed up value would be close to the correct value, especially first of all. So everywhere else you're just adding up the rewards, and the only place where you are taking a shortcut is the very last state. The deeper the state is, hopefully the less problematic any error in that estimate is. In particular, if you're actually lucky and this is a sync state, then you would know its value exactly. Okay, so either you would have reached a sync state and then stay in it forever and ever, or you actually, you know, went infinitely long. Okay, if you're thinking of Markov addition, thinking of MDPs with sync states, then essentially you would reach the sync state and then you stay there for infinitely long time. Okay. Either way, in that case, you just back up directly, and you are essentially only using the estimate for the deepest state. Okay, so the question is, why should we only consider this end and this end? Why not the middle guys? You know, here you just went one down and looked at the valuation of this. Here you went a lot more down and looked at the valuation of this. Essentially, this looks like the game tree idea, where you go as deep as you can and then apply your heuristic there. For you, heuristic is the value estimate, right? And then back up. So in essence, you can actually say that you take a behavior of size k, okay, where if k equal to 1, then that is, I'm sorry, if k equal to 0, then it is the temporal difference learning. K equal to infinity, then it is Monte Carlo learning. And there is a way in which you can combine. So in some sense, what you can do is you can take the backup from this, all of them, and weight them. And there is an idea called TD lambda, which essentially does that. Okay. And so what TD lambda does is it can be thought of as doing 1, 2, etc. up to k step predictions. Okay, so you do 1, 2, k step behaviors, and then back up from each of those. And then each backed up value is then weighted by a lambda. Okay, so in particular, this one is, you know, this one is 1 minus lambda weight, this is 1 minus lambda times lambda, 1 minus lambda times lambda square, and so on. And this one, and so any backup here, you would be multiplying it by 1 minus lambda. Any backup here, you will be multiplying by another lambda function, another lambda value. Okay. Obviously, lambda is between 0 and 1. Okay. If lambda is 1, then in essence, all these things become 0. The weights for all those backups become 0. Only this guy will be there. So TD lambda, where lambda equal to 1, will become what? Monte Carlo. Okay. And TD lambda, where lambda equal to 1 becomes Monte Carlo, lambda equal to 0 becomes just TD. And any value between 1 and 0 would be sort of, you know, a trade-off between, you know, temporal difference learning and Monte Carlo. Okay. About the only, and then it has some advantages in terms of the TD lambda for different values of lambda has the, you know, different trade-offs in terms of learning, you know, speed of learning. Okay. One interesting thing that is worth looking at here is this one doesn't have a 1 minus lambda, which is very important, because if it had a 1 minus lambda, then this 2 would have become 0. And the reason it doesn't have a 1 minus lambda is because this is supposed to be infinitely long, and it reached a terminating state at some t steps, capital T steps. After that, the same exact, you'll stay in the same state, collecting the same state reward infinitely often. But it's being discounted by gamma. Okay, and so because of that, there'll be a 1 by 1 minus lambda factor. Okay, and that 1 minus lambda and 1 minus lambda gets canceled out. The interesting point about this is that TD and Monte Carlo are essentially at the two ends of the same spectrum. Okay. And then in general, there are like a variety of, you know, minor changes in reinforcement learning algorithms based on at least these dimensions. So for example, in this case, on top you have full backups. Okay, that basically means, a full backup basically means I actually look at all my neighbors and all the actions I can do, and do either max over the actions or expected value of the single action. You would do expected value of the single action if you're doing passive learning. You will do max over all the actions if you're doing active learning. Okay. So this one in here essentially is the full backups. Okay. And on this side of the spectrum, so that's full backup. This is backups based on individual samples you actually experience. Okay. So for example, temporal difference learning looks at what actually happened rather than, you know, consider all the things that could have happened and, you know, back up using the value functions from those neighbors. Okay. So this is full backup, this is, you know, a sample backup. And then there is another dimension is shallow backups and deep backups. Okay. So this one is a shallow backup. Temporal difference is a shallow backup because it just backs up after one. You can go deeper. That would be Monte Carlo. What's interesting is you can also do this here. Even in dynamic programming based backups, even DP based backups, you can just go one level and consider the values of those states and then right away back them up. Or you can go multiple levels, consider only apply the value estimates to the bottom states and then back it up using the DP. Okay, the assumption is you do this, per backup cost would be much higher, but the backed up value would be more accurate. Okay. So you can pick any of these, and then you know you have a different kind of an algorithm. You have a Monte Carlo algorithm, you have a temporal difference learning algorithm. If you want to combine these two, you have TD Lambda, which is sort of in between. Okay. And then you can also have a dynamic program algorithm, exhaustive search, where it goes all the way down, and then limited search. Basically here, each of these nodes are terminal nodes. This is just one step look ahead. And in between would be partial look ahead, k-step look ahead. And those all will be different reinforcement learning algorithms, essentially. Okay, it's different strategies of how much you're going to use your model, and you know, versus how much you're going to wait for the actual behavior to be observed. Okay. Okay. So the next part that I want to talk about is this idea of large state spaces, and you want to represent the value. I mean, this I assume you guys have read, you know, value function as some features of the current state, and then essentially directly modify the function weights, the feature weights, so that you will get a close fitting to the actual value function in terms of this weighted feature function. Okay, and the reason for this, of course, is that if you do the previous way, you have a big table, and the tables don't generalize. So if you haven't seen S95, you don't know the value of S95. Whereas if S95 is very close to S47 in terms of the features, then probably you would be able to figure out what its valuation will be. Okay. So one idea would basically be to write the value function in terms of some linear combinations of features, where the parameters now would be these theta values or the weight values. Okay, so now of course you need to still figure out what is the right kind of features to look at. Okay, but if you decided what the features are, I mean, this is the usual classification learning problem. Whenever you're doing classification learning, you need to figure out what your feature space is. But once you figured out the feature space, then I have decided that I'm going to look for the best linear summation over the features. Now again, those of you who know anything about classification learning before coming here know that you don't have to go with linear. You could go with nonlinear. You can go with kernel-based methods and all that fun stuff. Okay, but I'll just sort of go through the linear version, and then everything else is also, you can export that, import that into the reinforcement learning. So the interesting thing now is a classification learner's problem is being set up as a subroutine of the agent's behavior in the world. Okay, and it will be useful for the classification learner to be an online learner. That means it should be able to take more examples and improve its weights. Some more examples, it improves its weight again, and so on. Okay, and then these examples essentially are saying that, of course, you know, can you do this? Can you write features such that values can be approximated, first of all? Okay, well, it depends on the space of the features. So for example, if you are considering x and y as the features, x coordinate and y coordinate as the features of states here in this grid, okay, and if the value function is 10 here and 0 everywhere else, it turns out you can learn that in terms of features. That function can be written in terms of the features. Okay. So in the sense that it will know, you know that it's 10 here. We don't know what its value is in other places, but definitely it's 10 here. Okay, so you will be able to get that to be a 10 there. There is a linear function in terms of these features. Okay, but on the other hand, if 10 was here, then there won't be a linear function in terms of the XY features. But you can write a different feature z, which is essentially the distance away from 3, 3, Manhattan distance away from 3, 3. Okay, and then in terms of z, you have a linear function. All this is saying is this is sort of repeating the fact that everything can be linearly separated if you keep increasing the number of features. Okay, but you know, that's just, this is, if you never heard of linear regression and you're wondering can something be actually regressed linearly, there are two ways of doing it. The one obvious way in which you can find a linear regression for any function is to come up with nonlinear features. Okay, you can be linear in the space of nonlinear features, in the space of a larger, you know, set of features. Okay, so we will assume that the features are given and then we just need to kind of figure out what these weights should be. So for that, you do least squares fitting, you know, least squares best fit approximation. So the idea would be that you would know the values, the expected values for this state, which would be your current value estimate function. Okay, and this is what is estimated according to this function. And you can see the difference between what is estimated and what should be the value, and then you want to reduce that difference. And so you want to set the values theta 0 to theta n such that the difference between the predicted and the actual value is minimized, or at least the errors, the sum of the errors is minimized. Okay, that's your normal least square fit. So the way you'd normally do this is, because these are continuous theta values, you do gradient descent in the space of theta. Okay, and the basic idea, I mean, does anybody, do people know gradient descent? Okay, so all we are doing is that it's right now this is a function in the, what you're looking for is a function in the space of theta 0, theta 1, theta 2, and theta n. Okay, and you are, so it's an n plus 1 dimensional function, and you're trying to find its minimum. Okay, in fact, actually the way you'll get the function itself is, this is the estimated value. You can compute what the estimated value is minus what the real value is, and then square it. And normally people throw in a half because essentially the derivative of this will be 2 times something, and that 2 and a half just cancels out. But if you minimize half, you minimize the full. Okay. Anyway, so you are, you know, minimizing this square distance, the squared error. Okay. Now this error itself is a function now in the space of theta. In the space of theta. It's an n-dimensional function. Okay, and you're trying to find what is the value of theta such that this function would be minimum, the error would be minimized. It will not be zero, depending on the features you have, it may never be zero. But what's the closest you can get if all you're allowed is these features? Okay, and to do that, the usual idea, of course, is to, you know, if it's a two-dimensional function especially, you can see that if you're there and you want to get here, you want to take a step in the direction opposite to the direction of the gradient at that point. Okay, if it's an n-dimensional function, then you actually compute the gradient, which is a vector itself. It's an n-dimensional vector, and you want to take a step in exactly opposite direction of that vector. Okay, and the learning rate is some alpha times the gradient. If the alpha is big, then you're making huge, big steps, which means you might actually cross this over and go this side. If the alpha is small, you're kind of creeping all the way here. And then you can change the alpha such as in the beginning it is high and then becomes low when you are closer to the minimum. This whole thing is the usual gradient descent method for finding function minimum in the context of continuous functions. Because in general, hill climbing, so this is essentially the analog equivalent of hill climbing that you have heard of in discrete search. Okay, so what you would have done in discrete search, in hill climbing, is if you are in a particular point, you look at its neighbors and you will see which of the neighbors are most promising and you commit to that. in a continuous function, it's not very obvious what the neighbors are, because even if you just give epsilon as the region, there are infinite number of neighbors. So instead, you would essentially directly compute the direction of maximum change, which is this, and then take the negative of it. Okay? And then that's basically what your gradient descent is. You'll keep hearing about gradient descent from now until the end of statistical learning, because you wind up optimizing some function or other. It's continuous optimization. Okay. So there again, gradient descent is just the 101 of function optimization. There are many better methods in terms of, in general, you can, for example, not only take the gradient information into account, but the second derivative information into account in deciding that the whole story is how to come close to the minimum fast. Okay, there are all sorts of methods. They are like, you know, just as you have heard of multiple types of hill climbing methods, there are multiple types of function optimization methods. Some of you probably already know of this if you have done any continuous function optimization course. Okay, but we will just start with gradient descent. Okay, for example, if you take second order derivatives also, then you will start having Hessians. Okay, a Hessian essentially would be an n square size matrix. If there are n variables, a gradient is a n sized vector. A Hessian is a second derivative. You get to decide second derivatives, you know, with x1, x2, where x1, x2 are ranging over x0 to xn. Okay? And so there will be, you know, an n square matrix, and you combine that along with the gradient to make your step size. Okay. Typically, in fact, you know, one of the things is that making steps using the Hessian information turns out to be the best thing you can do, but it's too costly. And so here is gradient descent, here is Hessian-based descent, and in between there are a huge number of methods which sort of try to take into account the Hessian information without having to compute it. Okay, but suffice it to say that for now we'll just care about, you know, simple gradient descent. And it's not surprising that gradient descent will work for, you know, all gradient descent will guarantee is to get you to the nearest minimum. If the nearest minimum is not the global minimum, there is no guarantee whatsoever. Okay, and so basically one big deal in this scenario, and we'll talk about it later too, is that one big deal in this scenario is, can do we have any reason to believe that this function is convex? If a function is convex, normally the definition of function being convex is okay, so this is f of x1, this is f of x2, this is f of x1 plus x2 by 2. Right? And you consider a function to be convex if f of x1 plus x2 by 2 is smaller than, so it's in between, essentially. Okay, because based on the average of these two, you would have thought this value should be here. Do you see what I'm saying? If the function was a line, right, then f of x1 plus x2 would be here. If it is convex, it will be below the line. If it's concave, it will be above the line. Okay, the good thing is, if a function is convex, this is a for all definition. That means for any 2 points x1 and x2, the function's value for the average of x1 and x2 is lower than the average of the function values themselves. That means it can only have one minimum. Okay, in those cases, gradient descent will work beautifully. You don't need to worry because there's only one minimum and you'll find it. Okay, well, actually, no, it's not that you will definitely find it, because you could, for example, this is, you know, this. That would be convex. So in this area, this could be like a very low slope. Okay, and so in this area, you won't know exactly which direction, you know, the right direction to go. Okay, I'm not, you will know the right direction, but the progress would be slow. Okay, but when you reach the minimum, that would be the global minimum, because the function is convex. Okay, we'll talk about this in many cases. If in fact the function happens to be convex, you know, we'll assume that the problem is simpler than otherwise. Okay, that's not the case here. It's not obvious at all that the function is convex in this case. It's just an arbitrary error function. Okay, so we will just assume this is the error function, and then you want to compute the partial derivatives because you need the gradient, and the partial derivative, and then make a step in the opposite direction of the partial derivative. So in essence, actually what you really want to do is the theta vector is made to be theta vector minus gradient times alpha times gradient of the theta vector. The gradient itself is a small vector. Okay, so you subtract the like dimensions from the theta vector, and you will essentially get new set of theta values. And if you think of it as each dimension separately, theta I would be old value of theta I minus alpha times the partial derivative just with respect to theta I. Okay. Now, to do the partial, so you need these partial derivatives. This is a big deal. The reason partly I'm spending time here is because we'll need this again for statistical learning. And so I might as well spend time here and make sure that everybody understands this. If you already know this before, you're kind of bored. But if not, at least you would know, you know, the simple, the basics of multidimensional function optimization, continuous function optimization. Okay, so you take the partial derivative for the error in this particular case with respect to theta I, then using the chain rule, you can do this. The error is written in terms of v theta. V theta itself is written in terms of theta. So you know, if you want to do the derivative of sin x square, then you can do derivative of sin x, sin u, which will be cos u, right? And then the derivative of x squared with respect to x, which will be 2x. So 2x cos x squared, right? That's what we are doing here. Derivative of E with respect to V theta, and then derivative of V theta with respect to theta I. Okay, now this is easy because this is just 2 times the middle, right? So this one is just the V theta part, and this depends on the actual form of how V theta depends on the theta I. Okay, if it's a linear function, then essentially the feature value would be the only part of the derivative. Remember, if your function was, in our case, we assume that the function was theta I times fi. So the partial derivative of this whole thing with respect to theta I, everything else becomes zero except the theta I, where the theta I goes away and fi remains. Okay, so if you do that, then in essence you have, this would be your update step, and you make these updates. This is gradient descent. Now the interesting question, of course, is that I need to figure out what is the real value expected minus the current value that is estimated. Okay, so every time you see a new value, for new value estimate for the state, and the previous value estimate for the state is considered wrong, and the difference between them has to be bridged. And to bridge that, essentially you take the new value minus the estimated value times alpha times the feature, and then add it to the, that. So you now basically, you're changing the weights themselves such that your interest is to make this difference between the old value of this state and the new value of this state be closer. To do that, you will essentially change the theta i's that define how the value of this entire state is defined in terms of the individual features. When you do this, when you make it come closer to this guy's value, you, in essence, the same function is being used across the state space. So you have changed it everywhere else too. In normal value iteration, in normal value update, when you change the value of a state, other people's values have not changed because it's a tabular lookup. Right now, to make this guy happy, you change the theta values, but the same theta values are used by everybody. So everybody's values changed, in essence. That's the generalization aspect. Okay? So what should be the target value in the case of, it depends on what is supposed to be the expected value for this state. Okay, if you're doing temporal difference learning, the expected value will be the value for the previous lower state, plus, you know, gamma times the value for the lower state plus the reward. If you're doing Q learning, it would be the max of the values from the lower state plus the reward. Okay, so in this particular case, if you're doing, you know, TD learning, which is passive learning, and you know the policy, okay, then the expected value should have been for S should have been reward for S times the expected value, estimated value for S dash. This will then be plugged in here, and this is the value for S according to your current function. So that would then change the theta values. Okay? And every time you see an example, you change the theta. You no longer change the values directly, you change the thetas directly. And in changing the thetas, you're making changes everywhere. All the values are changing. Okay? And in general, this it's a very interesting question as to whether this is ever going to converge. Okay, under certain conditions, you know, you can show that reinforcement learning with function approximation will converge, but we won't go into the proofs here. We'll assume that it's a reasonable thing to do. Okay, so that's basically what we just saw. Okay, and if you're doing Q learning, you would do a max over the Q values. Okay. So the difference between Q learning and TD lambda, the temporal difference is, you normally assume TD is a passive learner. That means it has a single policy that it's following. In the case of Q learning, you're also figuring out what's the right policy. Okay? Any questions? Okay. The other thing is that, so if you do this, and in general, essentially, this is one, I mean, I have to say that value functions are being represented now as a linear function over features of the states. But there are other ways of representing value functions in terms of the features of the states. One of which is, for example, things like ADDs, okay, basically which are the numeric equivalent of the binary decision diagrams. Okay, so you would say if this feature is having this value, then if this other feature has this value, then the total value for the state should be this much. Otherwise, it should be this much. So you would wind up learning the ADDs directly. And there are ways of, you know, directly learning ADDs, just like there are ways of directly learning the linear functions here. We'll just look at this as an example of generalization. Okay. And there is also a huge interest in figuring out what would be the right features, because the feature space to some extent is much more important. Okay. If you get the right feature space, you can then become linear in that space. Whereas if you use the wrong feature space, then the closest linear approximation may still be quite far away from the value function. So for example, remember the one where if you had this, and if you tried to just use x1 and x2 as the features, the best you would do would still be too far away from the correct value. Whereas if you threw in this additional feature, which is made up from x and y, then that'll be closer. Okay. Okay. So the last thing that I want to say on the reinforcement learning, and very quickly, is policy gradient part. Again, it's a pretty deep topic. I'll want to at least get you an idea as to how you can start changing the policies directly. Because as I said last time, one way is to change the policies as, again, as first learn the value function and convert into the policies. Okay. So the problem basically for policy search, so the motivation, of course, is why not directly search in the space of policies? And so you want to learn the policy that maximizes the expected rewards from the state that you are in. Okay. So the simple idea is to start with an initial a Q function. Remember, to learn policies, all you need is Q functions. Okay. And the max of the Q would be the action you're supposed to be taking. Okay. So start with the initial Q function, and then nudge each feature weight up and down to see if your policy is better. Now, for this to happen, basically the Q function itself should be parameterized in some features of the state. And so you say, this is my feature. My feature is that if X is, you know, if X plus Y is greater than 3, then I should go up, otherwise I should go left. That might be your policy, for example. And then nudging it means saying if X plus Y is greater than 3.3, then go up, otherwise go left. Okay? So you're just changing the policy slowly. The problem is, the big problem in policy update is, how do you know that the policy got better? Okay? And the basic idea is that to see that the policy got better, you need to actually run, empirically evaluate that policy. You run that policy, you know, if you want to consider what is the expected value of initial state that you're starting from, if you're using this policy, then you run this policy starting from this state, let's say 100 times. Each time you behave up to 100 states. Okay, and then you compute the backed up value, and then you take the average. That's the expected value you can get for this state if you use this policy. If you have a different policy, you do the same thing and you can see whether it's better. Right? So if I do it this way, then already I have an idea of doing hill climbing. Right? So I am in a policy, and one of the advantages is policies are actually discrete space. So I'm in a policy, I can look at my neighborhood policies and then see which of them is the most promising, that means which of them is much better than me, and then commit to that. And then do it again. So from a conceptual point of view, it's easy enough to understand that, you know, you just need to do empirical valuation of the policy, and then you pick the best policy in your neighborhood and commit to it, and then do it again. Okay. The question, of course, is can you somehow convert this into more like a gradient descent or gradient ascent algorithm? Okay. To do that, you want to convert what is a discrete set of policies into a continuous set of policies. You need to convert into a continuous set of policies. And that's what I was talking about at the end of last class. You know, when you convert into a continuous set of policies, then you can essentially talk about derivatives in that case. Okay. So to convert in, so suppose you have a policy which is parameterized in terms of some theta function. Let's assume that the policy is the Q values are written in terms of theta times Fi. Okay, and the policy is parameterized in terms of these thetas. Then you can talk about the reward function itself is a function of the theta values now. The expected reward of the policy is some unknown function of the theta values. We don't know what it is, but, you know, let's assume you know that. Okay, let's assume, call that rho theta. Then basically what you want to do is do gradient descent on that, a gradient ascent on that, to get to the highest point of that rho theta. Okay, just like you descended the error function, you are now ascending the reward function, where the reward is expressed in terms of the set of the parameters. Okay? And then, you know, and the gradient descent steps, gradient ascent steps in this case will be, you know, since you're ascending, you don't do minus, you do plus. Okay, you go towards the maximum. And so you say theta is theta plus alpha times the gradient of the rho theta. Okay, conceptually it looks easy enough. Okay, now of course you don't expect this to be directly available in closed form, so you need to do empirical evaluation of the gradient. Okay, but it's better. So one of the advantages is coming here is when you do empirical evaluation of the gradient, a gradient will only basically be having, you know, a bunch of partial, so if you have n theta values, then you only need to compute the estimates of n partial derivatives at that point. Okay, and then you can then use that to modify the theta values. Okay, I'll talk about that in a minute. So it's important to sort of in your own head, compare this idea to think of policies as discrete and look at some neighborhood of current policy and look at which is the best. There, the neighborhood can be arbitrarily large or small, depending on what you do. Here, you essentially say the neighborhood is defined in the calculus terms. In terms of, you know, for the infinitesimally small changes, what is the derivative direction? Okay. Now the problem, of course, is that the way I have rho theta, it's essentially going to be discontinuous because rho, the reward is based on the policy. Policy is discrete, right? If, for example, you are in a particular state and you have two actions, okay? You have two actions, and as theta is being changed, the q theta with respect to a1, this is q theta with respect to a2. Okay? Now the q functions themselves are varying linearly. Okay, but what you wind up picking, the reward you wind up picking will be in this region, you will pick A1. And so you will get the reward of A1. All this whole region, you will get the reward of A1. And in this region, you will pick A2, so you will get the reward of A2. And there's an abrupt transition right there. Okay, and it's this reward, rho theta, that you are trying to find the gradient of. Okay, and so obviously so you cannot actually find gradients of discontinuous functions, and so you want to convert into a continuous function. Okay, so it's important to understand that these are already continuous functions. The q values are continuous functions. It's just that the policy is max over q values. Max is a discrete function. Okay. So instead, what you do is you go to a probabilistic policy, which is what I was saying last time. So you'll assume that the probability, so pi theta SA, is not the specific action that you will be picking with probability 1, but rather pi theta SA would be probability that you will pick action A in state S. So the kind of deterministic policies we talked about before basically would correspond to policies where PRA given S is either 1 or 0, not in between. But now you are allowing it to be any number in between. Okay? And so the basic idea then is, in some sense, you are likely to pick this action more than this action. But how exact, which action you will actually pick, is all you know is the probability of picking this action is higher than the probability of picking this action. But the probability of picking this action is not 1 here. Okay, and the differences between probabilities become closer and closer to 0. So by the time you come here, they will be essentially, you know, 0.5 and 0.5. Okay, that's what you're trying to do. So there are many ways you can convert this into a probability distribution. One way, of course, is this Boltzmann distribution, where you say, you know, exponential, I mean, e power the q theta. So if you are considering the probability of getting action A, okay, so you, that would be exponential of e power q theta of SA by the sum of all the q thetas. So all I'm just saying is essentially what you would have thought about here. In this case, the probability of picking this is this divided by this plus this. Mostly that's what you want to say. Okay, the e power is syntactic sugar, essentially to say that as things start diverging, the probabilities change faster. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, but as far as we are concerned, it will still be the distributions themselves would be continuous. They will be changing continuously. So it's kind of an interesting thing that having convinced ourselves that you never have to deal with mixed policies, we are dealing with mixed policies here. Having convinced ourselves that distributions are bad things, palm DPs become bad because they have to deal with distributions over states, while MDPs only have to, you know, deal with states themselves, we are actually going into distribution, you know, policy as a distribution over action. Okay, and the reason for that is because you want to do the gradient search rather than the hill climbing search. That's also surprising to some extent. If you think about it, here is a discrete space of policies. And you would think hill climbing is good for discrete space. It's just that you don't know how to define the neighborhood. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, if you think of something like min conflict SAT problem, where you define the neighborhood in some reasonably arbitrary way, you say, I will consider as the neighborhood all the assignments that just flip one of the variable's values from true to false. That's one small neighborhood. Another neighborhood would be that flip up to two. Another neighborhood would be up to three. And if you say all up to k, where k equal to the total number of variables flipped, and when k becomes n, then you are considering the entire space. Okay, and then in the space itself, you have to exhaustively compute the goodness of each of the assignments. In the case of min conflict SAT, for each assignment, you then compute how many clauses are still violated. That would be its score. The score for us would be for each neighbor policy, you need to empirically evaluate how good that policy is. The bigger the neighborhood, the more work you have to do. Each policy itself, you may probably want to at least simulate it 100 times, 1,000 times, and each time you will at least have the, you know, behavior be about 100 long, let's say. Now, as the neighborhood changes, it keeps increasing without bound. Okay, whereas by converting this into an equivalent continuous problem, it turns out that you now can, all you need to do is estimate the gradient. Estimate the gradient. And it turns out, the funnily enough, this slide is an interesting slide. Actually, I think I pretty much stopped with that. That's the last but two slides here for this topic. So pay attention. So in this case, you are, rather than estimate the quality of each of the neighborhood policies, you're estimating the partial derivative of the reward function. And then you will use that in the direct, gradient ascent method to change the theta values. Okay, it turns out that even if you want to do it just the dumb way, which is like empirical estimation, what you basically do is for each, remember the gradient is dou rho theta by dou theta 1, and dou rho theta by dou theta 2, and so on up to theta n. Okay. So to estimate this, you just go to the definition of partial derivative. What's the definition of partial derivative? It's essentially take rho of this whole thing plus theta I plus epsilon. Only in theta I's case, you increase the value of theta I by epsilon, minus rho theta divided by epsilon as epsilon tends to 0. That's the definition of partial derivative. Okay, so you can pick a little small epsilon. Right, and then actually compute this difference, divide by epsilon. Do it yourself calculus, right? Okay? And no, but the point is, this is quite different from bunches of things that we have learned until this point in this semester, but this is the coin of the realm in the context of continuous optimization. It's the whole problem in continuous function optimization is how to get the gradient effectively. And people will write papers when they find some easy way of computing the gradient, which would not take as many samples as somebody else's approach, for example. Okay, and we will keep seeing this when we go into statistical learning. So this is like a nice middle point, because we will start thinking more in terms of these gradient ascent methods. Okay, so, and then the other thing, of course, is here you only need to compute this value for n, you know, for n of the directions, n of the theta values. Okay, so this requires estimating just n plus, I mean, so theta 0 to theta n, so you have to estimate n plus 1 of these values. Now, these values are basically, rho theta is the expected value of the current policy. You computed that already. Okay, and then these are now, you are essentially defining your neighborhood. Remember, the question was, if I am a policy, what's my neighborhood? I'm just saying my neighborhood is defined exactly in terms of theta 1 being increased by epsilon. That's one guy. Theta 2 being increased by epsilon while theta 1 remains and everything else remains constant. That's the second guy, and so on. So you now have n policies around you, and you compute the values of those n policies. And that you convert that basically you see that as the gradient vector in deciding how to modify the theta value. That's basically what you're doing. Okay? So how do we estimate these quantities, rho theta, and you know this and each of these with respect to I to 1 to n? For each set of the parameters, simply execute the policy for n trials or episodes and average the values achieved across the trials. Now the problem, of course, one big problem is this is empirical evaluation of a policy. What if while you're trying to execute the policy in the world, you die? You're trying to learn what's the best policy. In trying to learn what's the best policy, it's what's the best way to walk on the rim of Grand Canyon, or what's the best way to do helicopter flying, inverted helicopter flying, let's say. And then you basically, each Q function is in terms of these continuous theta values, and you're trying to change these theta values. What if you change the theta value in the wrong direction for one of the dimensions and the, you know, Lockheed helicopter falls down? Right? It's not just computational time now. It is helicopter dying time. Okay? So what happens is that policy gradient approaches are used exactly when there are simulators available. So in fact, one of the poster childs for the policy gradient approach, it turns out that actually policy gradient approach was used for probabilistic planning. The one that we talked about, the FF hop stuff, there is actually a planner called FPG, which used policy gradient approach to learn the optimal plan and then execute it. Which actually, if you guys were awake, which I don't really believe because today is the most sleepy class I have seen, and there are people who are not here physically and there are people who are not here mentally, and combine that, there's only one or two left. But if you were actually awake, then you would actually be scratching your head saying, why are people entering probabilistic planning competition and using reinforcement learning techniques? Probabilistic planning competition model is given to you. There's nothing to learn. Why using reinforcement learning? Think about this. We'll talk about this next time. Okay. Again, it's essentially laziness. Okay. So you want to kind of experience the part of the model that's actually needed, as against do full inference on the model. And in fact, a very interesting point is that reinforcement learning is used across the board even when models are available. But the models are so hard to handle analytically that you would just let the experience tell you which pieces are really happening to you. and only learn what to do in those cases. It's sort of, you know, you should scratch your head because we got into reinforcement learning because we thought we didn't have a model. But I'm telling you that one of the times, you know, a planner which actually won the probabilistic planning competition, and of course the winning there also was quite iffy because the actual winner was a deterministic planner completely ignoring probabilities, FFP plan. Having said that, you know, you are not allowed to win probabilistic planning competition and thrown that planner out, then among the remaining planners, FPG was the winner. Okay, but it was, you know, it basically it was winning over planners which directly use the model. And this one is using it for reinforcement learning. Okay, and it was computing the policy by the policy gradient method. Another poster child, I mean, this is probably not as much of a poster child, but the real poster child for this policy gradient approach, if I have a picture somewhere here, is, you know, you can go to Andrew Ng's webpage, and he basically got, you know, a helicopter to learn how to do all types of, you know, maneuvers. Like it will automatically learn inverted flying, which, you know, me, I have no clue how to, you know, I never got into a helicopter, okay? But I'm told by people that, you know, doing inverted flying of a helicopter is extremely hard to do. And you really need to just know how to balance everything in the right place. Okay? And so he learned that. Okay? He learned means not him. You know, he, I don't think, can actually fly, you know, but he can get his machines to fly. And how did he make them fly if he's actually computing policy empirically? You know, Stanford is a rich university, but I don't think it's anywhere near rich enough for Andrew to keep losing, you know, helicopters one a second. Right. Even toy helicopters, one a second is too bad. What he has instead is a pretty good simulator for the helicopter flying. And if you have a simulator for the helicopter flying, you can do these estimates on the simulator. It takes time, but does not cause actual physical damage. And then when you are ready, then you go far, far away from any university crowds and see if it actually works. And if it works one time, take a quick video and put it up on the web. And that's what actually he did. I mean, in fact, he was able to learn this stuff. Okay, and I think the actual numbers of how much he, you know, training he had to do, etc., is available on that inverted helicopter stuff. Okay, so it's a pretty interesting, impressive idea, actually. But it's very, you know, doable without permanent damage if there is a simulator. And it would not be doable without permanent damage if you don't have a simulator and you have a non-ergodic domain. Helicopter is a notoriously non-ergodic domain. The thing knows how to fall, but not how to get up. Right? Okay. Okay. So this requires only, in this case, n times n plus 1 episodes to get the gradient estimate. You know. And while this can work well in many situations, it's not often a practical approach computationally. It's still not practical enough because it depends on how many thetas are there. First of all, how many parameters are there. And the parameters depend on the number of features for the state. Each feature gets its own weight parameter. Right? And it turns out the stuff that I'm actually skipping right here, because much of this is not already in the textbook. Right? I mean, I was teaching you a little more than what was in the textbook on the policy gradient. But policy gradient goes further than this. One very interesting idea is that you actually can do partial analytical, you know, derivation of the rho theta. Okay, if you're interested, read the rest of the slides that I've skipped. Okay, actually starting here. Okay, so you can actually do partial analytical estimation of the gradient, which will allow you not to have to handle these at all if you just have rho theta and you have some math. Then you will essentially get the effect of, you will be able to get the gradient without having to estimate each of these, you know, smaller policies. That makes policy gradient even more effective. Again, understand that none of this is ever going to work if, in fact, your policy, I mean, if there is no easy way of writing your policy as a parameterized function of the features of the state. most cases, you know, what happens is if the features are not clear and that there'll be too many features, many of them are irrelevant, and you throw in a theta for each, then you're dead. Like one simple idea for a helicopter thing is to essentially, you basically can wind up saying anything about the image that you are seeing. So if you start seeing greenery too close to you, that means you are not far enough from the ground. You probably are in the trees, let's say. Now, that's a feature. That feature, how are you going to get it from what your sensors are getting you? You know, defining the right features and, you know, keeping them small enough that you don't have to deal with too many weight factor, too many weights in the weight vector is a big issue. Okay, I will send you the link to FPG paper and probably also a link to this other guy's thing. Okay, but it's a, in some sense, policy gradient approaches really are interesting in the sense they are the plan space approaches. They are like partial order planning, where you directly search in the space of plans. Instead of looking at the goodness of a state, which is what forward state space planning, backward state space planning, etc. do, you ignore the states, you just go directly in the space of plans. Okay, and you're changing the policy, tweaking it a little bit to make it better. Now the question, of course, is to have some mathematical basis to this tweaking, you want to be able to write it as some sort of a gradient descent approach. Okay, and you know, the stuff that I'm leaving out actually is an example of the kinds of issues that you will face, which is if you can do analytically, I mean, there was this, you know, beautiful thing I used to have on my computer for a while, that a week in front of the computer can often save as much as a half an hour in the library, right? Right? And so a week doing empirical evaluation for each problem can often save, you know, a little bit. I mean, if you can do some analytical computations up front, then you can avoid this problem. This. Okay? So if on the other hand your head hurts in trying to do analytical gradient estimate, you just go and do calculus from first principles, you know, by numerical techniques. Okay? Numerical techniques will work all the time. It's just that when there is analytical techniques, they're way faster. And you want to do numerical only if the analytical is out of the question. That's typically the name of the game here. Okay, so I will stop for reinforcement learning here. And I have, you know, five minutes probably. And I'm going to start talking about what I'll really talk next class, which is statistical learning. And all I will do today is to say that, you know, I mean, to some extent you're doing reinforcement learning, and then, you know, basically statistical learning is a step down because it's essentially you're talking about, you know, learning when labeled information is given to you already. That's what we're looking at right now. Okay. But we will look at what many of you probably have some background in machine learning. If you have done intro to AI, you would have heard some machine learning techniques. Okay, so I'm just going to, you know, focus only on statistical learning techniques. In particular, we'll start with Bayesian learning. And in today's class, all I want you to understand really is Bayesian learning is not different from Bayesian inference. For Bayesians, there is no difference between learning and inference. Okay, everybody else, they think there is a learning and there's an inference technique. So inference, you use the knowledge you have. Learning, you sort of, you know, make a hypothesis and stick to it. And then learning, you know, you use it. I mean, inference, you use it. You know, one of the interesting things we'll see is in Bayesian learning, it's all inference. Okay, and so an example is this. So basically, this, let's look at this, and we'll probably have to go back again next week, but, you know, just to start the discussion. Suppose you are seeing some bunch of, you know, examples and their labels. Okay, I assume you know classification learning. So you have a bunch of examples and their labels, and you're trying to learn a hypothesis. Okay, that will predict the label of an unseen new example. So the what Bayesian learners say is, suppose you have a bunch of hypotheses that are possible. These are the hypotheses that are possible, H1, H2, etc., up to HM, N hypotheses. Okay, and you tend to think normally learning involves figuring out one winner hypothesis among all of these. And what we'll see is you don't do that in Bayesian learning. All you do is you just compute the posterior on the hypothesis space based on the examples you have seen. So you start with some prior on these hypotheses, saying which is more likely, which is less likely. So that prior is P of H. That tells you which hypotheses are more likely to be true, which are less likely to be true. And as you see the examples, the data with their labels, you look at the data to compute this, which is the posterior of the hypothesis given the data. As the data keeps coming, you recompute the posterior of the hypothesis. Okay? And unless you're extremely lucky, this distribution doesn't have to be a impulse function. An impulse function means all probability mass is in one hypothesis, everything else is zero. It doesn't have to be that way. That is just a special case. In most cases, it might just become more peaked over certain hypotheses and less peaked in other hypotheses. Okay, now, so the data is allowing you to just compute the posterior using the Bayes rule. Posterior on the hypothesis. Okay? And then, given a new data point, okay, what you're trying to do is, having seen the old data and their labels, given a new data point, you want to compute its label. Right? That you would basically write Px given D in terms of Px given D and H given D. You can always condition on some intermediate variable. You choose to condition on these hypotheses. Okay? And we'll assume that if D and H, you know, X given D and H is the same as X given H, and H given D is what you got here. And this is just direct Bayesian rule. This is learning. This is learning. And there is no actual winner picking that happened anywhere. Okay, and so here is an example that you should look at before coming to the next class. In the textbook, this one is more colorful there. It's black and white. Essentially, the example he's doing is, suppose you have five kinds of, bags of candies. Five kinds of bags of candies are possible. Okay, there is bag of candy type H1, which is 100% cherries. H2, which is 75% cherries and 25% lime. H3 is 50-50, then 25, 75, and 100. So this enormous multinational candy-making corporation only makes five different kinds of bags. Okay? And let's also assume that we know beforehand that this enormous multinational firm makes 10% of these bags, 20% of these bags, 40% of these bags, 20% of these, and 10% of these. That means of the total bags they make, they tend to make this 50%, 50% is made 40, when they make 1,000, they make 400 of these, only 100 of these, only 100 of these. Now, what are these percentages? Exactly, who said that? Okay, that's prior. Okay, so if you don't know anything, you could have put, 1 over 5 for each of them. But if you know, then you will use that. That's your prior, okay? So these are the different kinds of bags you have, and now you have right now, you close your eyes, you got a bag, you started taking candies out of this bag and, tasting it to figure out what its label is. Tasting it to figure out what each of the candies are. Now the question is, which bag is producing the candies you are getting? Okay, so suppose I got, candies out, and then in the beginning I just got a green, I'm a lime, okay? Then clearly this guy's probability becomes zero because he has no limes. This hypothesis probability now went from 10% to zero. Okay, these guys will increase at the expense of this guy. when you get a second lime, the more limey guy's probability increases. Okay? And when you get all limes, then essentially this guy's probability is falling down, this guy's probability is increasing. So in particular, this is a beautiful picture to keep in mind. This picture tells you the posterior probability on the hypothesis as the data is being seen. So the right way to see this picture is cross sections like this. So for example, here at 4, having seen 4 data points, okay, you essentially have decided this guy is close to 0, this guy is close to 0, this guy are higher probability. Okay, I have a sinking suspicion that the color coding is not right in this case, because this has to be all limes, but all lime candy is more likely, right? And all lime candy is H5, but H5 is blue. So they didn't use the right colors. Okay, so you actually are noticing that as you see more and more limes, the lime colored thing is becoming 0. That doesn't make any sense. What you are actually saying is the lime colored thing, which is this guy, is becoming very high. Now send a mail to Russell and ask him to make better slides now. Okay, but the point is, so in and this one is the prior distribution. Next you got this distribution. By this time you got this distribution. Notice the red guy became 0 and stayed at 0 because it was all red. And so the moment you see any lime, then it cannot be the bag from which the candies are coming from. Okay, now if I ask you to stop anywhere and ask you, you know, what would be the type of the next candy that you're going to draw? That's the prediction. Okay? If you stopped here, the next candy to draw, you could not have told. Basically, they're both 50-50%. If you stop here, it'll be more likely to be lime. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is the probability of it being lime is not just because of the winning guy. This guy also predicts some of its candies to be lime. This guy also predicts some of its candies to be lime. This guy also predicts some of its candies to be lime. And you take all those predictions and add them up to give you the summation of predictions. Okay? And so that's basically this computation. Again, no learning, just inference. So you started with a prior distribution on the hypothesis, and you kept updating the prior as you see evidence, which is the data, to get the posterior distribution on the hypothesis. And you use the current posterior distribution, which is your current knowledge, to compute what is the expected label, expected type of candy you're going to get next. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. And one of the interesting things is that, so you can see that it is becoming, you know, as the data, because you're getting, you know, increasing number of limes, the lime probability becomes 1.0. However, this prediction was not made by choosing a winning hypothesis, which is what you tend to think of learning. In normal learning, you think, among my hypotheses, this is the right hypothesis. I'm going to go with it and see what this guy says, what would be the label. Okay, this is a much more general idea where you are keeping track of the posterior on the hypothesis, and you are saying for each of these hypotheses what is the label and what's the probability of this hypothesis, and you get the expected label. It's the expected label that you're plotting there. Okay, and so that's what we computed. Okay, and you know, read this essentially this way: there is no difference between medical diagnosis and Bayesian learning. You go to your doctor, you have symptoms. And what you want to know from the doctor, really speaking, is not what my disease is, but am I going to die? Or am I going to have to miss the school tomorrow? I mean, that would be like a celebratory thing for you, but you know, right? So you, given some number of symptoms, you want the doctor to tell you whether other symptom also will happen. The symptom that everybody is interested in is, would I die, right? Okay, so you can actually compute the next symptom's likelihood based on the symptoms that you have seen till now. Just like you want to compute the next data based on the current data you have seen until now. In here, we considered hypothesis as an intermediary between the data, right? So the data causes the hypothesis which causes the data. Okay, and similarly, in the medical diagnosis community, you essentially invented this notion of diseases and even syndromes. And you say, based on your symptoms, the chance that you have this disease, this syndrome is this much. And I have a little textbook which says, based on this syndrome, the chance that it will cause this symptom is this much. Then I would be able to, so for example, here is the interesting thing. You, based on your symptoms, either you could be suffering from Ebola or common cold, 0.5, 0.5, let's say. Right? Suppose it turns out that common cold, you will have runny nose tomorrow. Ebola, you will have runny nose along with all other runny things. Right? Now, what's the probability of runny nose tomorrow? It's 1.0. Because either you're suffering from Ebola or common cold. Whereas a doctor who wants to pick one disease and only one disease will say you only have 50% chance of getting common cold tomorrow. Picking winners is not a good idea. We pick winners because of intellectual laziness. That's what Bayesians tell you. Picking winners is a reasonable idea if in fact your distribution is such that one guy is way above everybody else. In which case, whether you picked or not picked, it would have made a difference. Whereas if the entropy of the distribution is high, such that many diseases are equally likely, picking one of them and only treating you for that is an iffy thing. Do you see what I'm saying? So, medical diagnosis and full Bayesian learning are one and the same. And you heard of medical diagnosis when you learned elementary probabilistic reasoning. You look at the symptoms, you compute the probabilities of diseases. Based on the probability of diseases, you compute the probabilities of other symptoms. And so, so the last point for today's class is, for Bayesians, there is no such thing as learning. So Bayesian learning is an oxymoron. There is nothing different from Bayesian inference and Bayesian learning. Then the question is, why are we picking winners? Normally, learning means picking a winning hypothesis. That's what you have heard of before. Okay? Based on the examples, I pick a winning hypothesis. Based on that, I will then decide what the label would be next. When you come back next class, we'll essentially find out that there is trouble in the paradise. Because, you know, in this particular case, luckily enough, you had 5 hypotheses. What if you had 1,500 hypotheses? What if your hypothesis was a continuous hypothesis space? That means you have infinite number of hypotheses. Okay? Essentially, while conceptually it's a beautiful thing, figuring out how to compactly represent the posterior over the hypothesis becomes tricky. So, again, because of the intellectual laziness, we will, you know, people essentially have converted the Bayesian learning into, you know, either to map, where you pick a winning hypothesis based both on the likelihood of the hypothesis plus the likelihood of the data given the hypothesis, or maximum likelihood, where you don't even care about the likelihood of the hypothesis. You just pick as a prior likelihood of the hypothesis doesn't matter. Whichever is more consistent with the data is the one you pick. And it turns out that these guys work the same as Bayesian learning for the large data case. Because if the data just keeps coming without bound, then all your prior observations don't matter because the data will eventually decide what the posterior is. But for the small data case, it makes a huge difference. Okay, so we will understand that and we'll spend time in doing statistical learning with maximum likelihood and also Bayesian learning. Okay.